Blog Talk Radio.
Well, folks, welcome to Politics Done Right. I'm Nick Berkowitz, your host. Thank you so kindly for spending some of Saturday with me. We have a very tough subject today. And actually, we also have a friend of mine, the Jewish conservative, Bob Price, that will also come on and give his point of view, and we're going to see if we can touch common ground in the understanding of as much as I'm saying about a great week, it's really what has been a continuum in how I think and many believe, many have seen, the criminal justice system has worked for different people. So I want to have a frank discussion. That's why I titled it Trayvon Martin, the President, and Race. And the expectation is that folks can call. I don't care who you are, what political branch, party, what race or whatever. I'd like folks to call in after we, well, after or during when while we're talking, and be frank and honest and open-minded so that you can actually not just see or try to put a position out there, but meet and try to find understanding and why certain people, some people, all people, many people feel the way that they do. Let me start by reading this week's show. And it starts this way. This afternoon, or meaning yesterday afternoon, I got an IM from my conservative friend and blogger, Bob Price. He had heard that the president was talking about the Trayvon Martin case. He was also concerned about all the rallies and activities in Houston and surrounding areas and asked my thoughts on whether there would be problems. I told him I thought it would be peaceful. After all, hasn't it been peaceful most throughout the country for folks who've been really interested in the matter and not specifically those who were using this matter for ulterior motives? Moreover, after this radio show, I told him there's a good chance that I would go downtown and both interact and document what's going on out there with respect to Trayvon Martin. After we got into some conversation where we had some different points of view, I asked him to have this discussion, not as we were doing through IM, but let's do it on air because, you know, we have a healthy relationship where we can discuss differences, and that's what I wanted to do, and Bob graciously accepted. The president said that a lot of racial discourse must occur outside the realm of the political because within the political sphere, discourse has become ineffective. It is evident he knows politicians on all sides would demagogue the issue. I want to take the president's lead and discuss this issue frankly. So please, folks, call and join the conversation. You can also send me tweets to at Egberto Willis over Twitter. Again, you can tweet me at Egberto Willis, and you can go to the blog site, egbertowillis.com, see how to reach and get information out to the show. But I want to start by reading a blog post that I wrote. Actually, I wrote this a while back. It was on the front page of Daily Coast last week, I believe. And it's got several, I think, over 30,000 hits on iReports at CNN. Actually, quite a bit more than that. But here it goes, because this is an experience. This is my experience, but it's by no means an isolated experience. It's more the norm for folks who look like myself. So here it goes. And then we'll bring in Bob and we'll start our discussion. My first stop in America was a little town called Brenham, Texas in 1979. It is home of the Texas famous Bluebell Ice Cream and Blinn Junior College. My ticket to study engineering in America was based on a music scholarship, but that's another subject. I was a wet behind the ears black kid that spoke with an accent in a country town. The black American kids were suspicious of me. The white American kids were curious. And the Hispanic American kids giggled when I spoke to them in Spanish. I hung out with Peruvians, Argentinians, Guatemalans, and Venezuelan friends most of that year. You see, we were all strangers in a new land away from our parents for the first time who shared one thing in common. We could all communicate in Spanish, and when things happened, we could either jump to our cocoon. It's amazing how quickly and quietly human beings adapt. We were walking down one of the few commercial streets in Brenham when some guys in a pickup truck just started shouting, "Nigger!" And if I remember correctly, something about being in the wrong part of town. It was directed solely at me because while we were all Latinos, walking down that street, I was the only black one. I remember going to Padre Island for spring break. Six of us packed like sardines in my car. I remember getting to the beach house and the coldness with which I was treated on the island compared to my geographic brothers and sisters from South and Central America. But the funny thing is, they never had a clue. I always knew Blinn was a stepping stone to move up, and I moved up to the University of Texas at Austin after a year at Blinn. I had no problems getting in on my own merit, but most of my friends assumed I got in thanks to some quota. They did not realize that as a foreigner, I did not qualify. Both students and professors in many instances went out of their way to remind me that I was another. I rallied on campus for UT's divestiture from South Africa, given their overtly brutal apartheid system. I understood that fighting injustices somewhere else helped to hold up a mirror to the injustices we faced locally. I remember being stopped many times by the police. It's not that I was a bad driver. Most of the stops seemed to have only to do with a desire to question me. It was never confrontational. You see, I did as I was told. You see, where I'm from, Panama, a dispute with an officer guarantees a cracked skull with no legal recourse. So, the cops in Austin likely thought I was a model citizen. From a young age, I always knew when and where to engage. I adapted. When I graduated from UT and went to work, I encountered the same preconceived notions. But work isn't the cops. I was vocal and never took any crap. Suffice it to say, I had 5 jobs in 5 years and finally formed my own company. When my own company became fairly successful, I moved to Kingwood, a nice suburb with a lot of trees, and a very good school system for my daughter. My first memorable experience in Kingwood was walking in the trails and passing a white woman who immediately held her purse tightly and looked at me with horror. I looked at her and simply shook my head, seething. Another time, I went cycling with one of my new friends and Another time I went cycling with one of my new friends and stopped into a convenience store. When we left the store, my friend simply said, "I get it now. I guess I was his only black friend." inside that store, he saw how differently a person with my skin color is treated. Comparatively, that is. It is 2013. I've been living in the United States for 34 years or so. The fact that we still mourn our Trayvon Martins mean there is a lot more work for us to do. Preconceived notions and irrational hatred still pollute human interactions. Sometimes these weaknesses are codified into law. Black boys and men are stereotyped. Incarcerated rates and crime rates are pointed to as justification for unequal treatment and fodder for false narratives. These numbers do not take into account the fact that young men in my neighborhood, a predominantly white neighborhood, do not go to jail for interactions they confess to, while young men in other neighborhoods are arrested indiscriminately. It does not reflect that sentences on minorities are harsher, and as such, their chances of being granted parole and rehabilitation are smaller. There are many Trayvon Martins out there. Many. It is sad that we have lost this beautiful young man. It is also sad that similar incidences occur frequently with very little news coverage. Trayvon's case seems to resonate perhaps because he was 17, good-looking, and did not have a record. Every mother, irrespective of color, could envision him as their son. Every father as well. And that touches our hearts. We sense the pain that Trayvon's real parents must feel. In the America we envision, an America where there is no other, such compassion for our fellow human beings is commonplace, and no one son deserves to die this way. Many are emphasizing that the fact that Mr. Zimmerman looked Hispanic. I'm not sure why. Does this irrelevant detail somehow exonerate him from suspicion or hate or a hate crime? Do they think that by presenting a narrative of minority on minority crime, they can diminish the meaning of this event? Do they hope that the news network will lose interest if they are reminded that typically they have ignored minority on minority crime? What is important to note is that within the Hispanic community, there are many races. The racism we know in this country is found in every country in Latin America. Many of my South and Central American friends could pass for white, just as Mr. Zimmerman can. They will struggle to assimilate, but ultimately they did. Many Americans want to see the Trayvon Martin case as a potential learning experience. I do not think this is likely because we are so resistant to the only real solution, which involves everyone getting out of their comfort zones. The trial is probative. The attempt to make dead Trayvon Martin a stereotypical, dangerous, violent black thug is in full vogue. Some attempt to assume the only reason Trayvon would have been shot is that he caused Zimmerman to do it. Many willfully attempt to make this plausible, even though Zimmerman followed Trayvon as if he was a criminal or prey. Citizens must speak up against the no-gun control bullies that use intimidation tactics and leads and loads of money to insist upon lawlessness when it comes to deadly weapons. If we are to resolve real racial problems, we each must take it upon ourselves to lead by example, speak with honesty, and allow others to feel free to speak with honesty or honestly about what is in their hearts and minds without holding it against them. Only when our feelings about one another are revealed can we address, adjust, correct, or corroborate them. Only when we've begun and maintained an open conversation about race and racism can we see past our preconceived notions and truly hear and see one another. Racism is not a problem with preassigned blame. Racism is simply a problem, and it belongs to all of us. Minorities do not have a monopoly on victimhood. The white majority does not have a monopoly on responsibility or guilt or anger toward those who would have them feel guilty. The slate must be wiped clean. We must carry no grudges and begin by asking ourselves and one another, is this the way we want to go on living? Divided, lacking trust, lacking civility, lacking patriotism, not only love of America, but also love of Americans. Some of us resist asking such questions with openness because we fear we might end up losing something we think we now possess. But whatever it is we have now with the status quo, is it so wonderful that we would risk it for a higher level of understanding and a more fair, inclusive, and united country? That's what I wrote a few weeks ago, actually a few months ago, and I modified it for a lot of the incidences that have occurred thus far. And I think this may be Bob Price that's here, and as you can, I think that's Bob. Is this you, Bob?
It is. Good morning or good afternoon. How are you doing today?
How you doing, Bob? What's going on?
Well, I appreciate the invitation to call in and talk with you on the show today about a very important issue that's facing our country and is being brought to a head because of the trial of George Zimmerman. And I think I hope this is going to be a good opportunity for us to really dig into this issue and talk about it from a variety of angles and see if we can help in some way move this issue forward.
That is why I wanted you on, Bob, because as you know, we are from two different ideological parts of the spectrum, but we still get along just fine and we can talk things out just fine. And I think if this sort of stuff is reflected across the board, we'll do just fine. One of the things that I read in the statement, and I want to find it in the piece that I wrote, because I think a lot of times what stops discussion is people hold back because they're fearful of being judged for what they say. And my contention generally is, I want you to say what you really feel, not to hold it against you or to give you a gotcha, but I want you to say that so that if necessary, I can correct you, or if necessary, I can see why it is that you feel how you feel. And I think that is what's lacking in a lot of the discourse. People a lot of times want to, one, have a gotcha moment, two, have a belief that that one has the right of permanent, how should I put this without sounding wrong, of permanent victimhood or victimer without responsibility. And that is what I want to get away from. I want to get to the point where we can say, this is what I think, and okay, let's hear it. And then after whoever speaks, not to look at that person and say, I want to judge you because you think that way. Because a lot of the way we think comes from way back culture and things that are hard to get around until you make that effort to do so.
I think I agree with a lot of what you said there. And was listening to your monologue earlier, and there was a lot of items in that list that you went through that really touched a lot of the issues that I believe in and would like to expand on further. You know, I listened to President Obama's speech in the press room that he gave this week, and a lot of things struck me. But one of the things he talked about was that you can't really bring politicians together. They're going to be afraid of what you just described as the gotcha moment or being judged for what they say and not speaking frankly. And I was glad to see him encourage that discussion to take place in the churches and in the homes and in the workplaces of people, because that's where people can sit down and talk frankly and not fear being judged and really work through the issue and make meaningful progress on it.
I agree 100%. Now, to get started, this is what where I wanted to come up. Do you have an understanding why many have taken the stance on the result of the trial, the outcome of the trial. Can you understand that?
Well, I can understand parts of it. There are, I mean, we have to accept, as part of our judicial system, we have to accept the verdict of a jury in a trial. The you know, the O.J. Simpson case, a lot of white people were very upset because they felt O.J. was guilty and he was found not guilty. They accepted that verdict and moved on. And in the Zimmerman trial, which I don't believe there ever should have been a trial of George Zimmerman, I think that trial was politically pressured and not based on facts of the law. And but in that case, you know, there's a resistance to accepting the jury verdict. And juries can be flawed, juries can make mistakes, but that is our system of government, and it's certainly one of the best in the world, although it does always have room for improvement.
Now, Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I just wanted to go back to the issue that I don't think Zimmerman should have ever been tried in the first place, and that the political pressure, and it even goes back to what President Obama said this week. I noticed in the early part of his speech this week that he expressed sympathy for Trayvon Martin's family and for the loss of Trayvon Martin, and expressed absolutely no compassion or thoughts or anything about George Zimmerman and his family and what he went through. And that moves to divide the country rather than unite the country. It looks like the President of the United States, the man who has the Department of Justice, the full weight and legal force of the Department of Justice at his disposal, is taking a side on an issue where he should be neutral while there's a criminal investigation and issues like that going on. And it really puts people at odds against each other when the president comes out and says something like that. His entire speech was all about one side of the case, and it wasn't anything about the other side of the case. And I just don't think that's proper for a proper role for the president of the United States.
Okay, before I answer that, Bob, let me just say 404, I see that your hands are up. And for other callers, I would love to get other people calling in. Please give us a call, 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. I want to have a frank and honest discourse. Now, Bob, I completely disagree with your interpretation of the tone that the president had. And this is where I speak about having to have a frank discussion. Let me hit your topics one at a time. Specifically, when you say that the president didn't address the Zimmerman family, I don't think this was about the Zimmerman family or per se was about the Zimmerman family, his speech, at all. It was about what occurs to black men and Trayvon Martin being the encapsulation of what has occurred to black men. And let me put it in this context, because this is important. And you, as a conservative white person, I think we need to really get this dialogue going, because whereas a lot of people may come back with you with the passionate hate and how could you feel that way and all, that's not how I'm coming. And why am I not coming that way? Because I know you personally. That's the reason the way you feel that way, I'm not coming to you with that righteous indignation form. But here's what I believe. The president, in effect, was saying a simple thing. Trayvon Martin, before we get into that, with addressing the president, the Zimmerman family, if I were to address the Zimmerman family, my first contention would be, how could you? And what do I mean by how could you? Within the span of the months before the trial, there was a complete online managed, and you know I'm a computer person. I write software, I understand the internet, and know how it flows. But there was a complete process that took place to make this 17-year-old child look like most people's visualization of that thuggish black teenager. And what is most interesting about that is that in as much as Trayvon Martin's father and mother were separated, there was a true loving relationship between Trayvon and his dad. So he was the wrong person to categorize as the thug with all the emails and the email trails and the stuff on the internet that, frankly, are not true. I mean, I've gone through the list. I've made sure I've verified the sources, et cetera, to prove that this guy was demonized. Was there a bit of marijuana found in his blood? Yes. Was there times that he put on the gangster type stuff and took pictures? Yes. But guess what, my brother? Here in Kingwood, my good white community, it's the same thing. You can go on any one of these young white teenagers' blog sites and see the thuggish type thing because, you know, it's that kind of a rebellious feeling that a lot of these kids have. They're gangster and doing these things. Now, the difference here is that he drew the attention of Zimmerman while he was walking home. He drew the attention of Zimmerman while he was walking home for what's the reason? Well, Zimmerman told everybody in the courthouse what the reason was. That was quite clear in the trial. And my question is, with Zimmerman having been the aggressor, when the president says, did Trayvon Martin, could he have stood his ground not knowing who it was that was following him? So I think when we look at it from different points of view, and if I were Trayvon, first of all, me speaking as a black man, and this is not a race card thing or whatever, Bob. What I wrote in my piece is true. In other words, friends that have gone out with me have noticed that there's another story that occurred occurred here that I didn't mention. We went to Lakey, Texas with a group of bikers, cyclists. We do a lot of cycling. And we went with a group. It was probably about 20 of us that went to Lakey, Texas. We go into a restaurant, and these are the things that make one wonder about the otherness. We go into a restaurant in Lakey, Texas, an Italian restaurant. All of us in cycling clothes sit down around the table, and the waiter brings two tickets. One ticket for me, and by the way, I forgot to mention, again, I was the only black person in the group. One ticket for me. We're all sitting together, and I'm interspaced within everybody else. She brings one ticket to me and another ticket for the group. Lakey, Texas. So what I'm trying to say is there are different points of view that has to be seen. Now, what the president did by speaking out yesterday may not have spoken to a whole lot of folks in let's say, the white community, but it spoke to a lot of my white friends because what they saw is finally coming from the top, the acknowledgement that we still have a lot more work to do. Now, so when you find the president's speech divisive, I have to find a way to let you understand what it was the president was trying to do. And you say, Bob.
Okay. Well, let me go first to one issue that you raised about the president bringing forward. Would the Stand Your Ground law have worked for Trayvon Martin? The Stand Your Ground law basically says that if you were in fear imminent harm or death, that you're allowed to use whatever force necessary up to and including deadly force or the threat of deadly force to stop that action and to defend yourself without the obligation to first retreat. Someone
Wait,
following
I'm sorry,
you
I'm, repeat that, repeat that. That's important what you just said. Repeat that again.
Okay. It basically allows you as an individual the right to defend yourself. If you're in fear of imminent severe bodily harm or death, to use any force necessary up to and including deadly force or the threat of deadly force to stop the situation without having an obligation to first retreat. In many
Let me
states,
hold you. I have to stop you right there, Bob, for one question, okay? And this is where I am with regards to the law, because depending on your answer, the law is then a unconstitutional law. But here's what my question. If you and I are together and I start a fight with you, I start to drag on you or whatever, okay?
Right.
Nobody's there, but I start to drag on you. And then you punch me, I drop on the floor, and guess what you're doing? What did that law just tell you? You could use deadly force if necessary. And you happen to get on top of me, and you start beating me because I started this fight with you. I started trailing you. I started this fight with you. Then I shoot you because you were banging my head on the floor. So I shoot you and you die. What happens to me?
That depends on a lot of things. You know, it depends on what witnesses are available to back up one side of the story versus the other. It depends on what the forensic evidence says that verifies what happened. You know, in the Trayvon Martin situation, nobody knows what occurred when the two people actually physically came face to face. Nobody knows what was said. Nobody knows who touched the other person first. All we know is what happened after that point, once the fight began. Zimmerman says that Martin showed up immediately in front and confronted him for following him. Following somebody doesn't give you the right to use deadly force to defend yourself because you're not in the imminent danger of bodily harm or death just because somebody's following you. But once he was on the ground, and we don't have any evidence to contradict his story, the forensic evidence is consistent with his story, and the witnesses that saw what happened once the fight began are consistent with his story. He was in a reasonable belief that he was in danger of imminent bodily harm or death. And was found legally justified in using deadly force to stop the attack.
Okay, now that you've said that, Bob, I want to ask you now, you've given me the legalese, okay? And nobody can argue the legalese because, first of all, it is whether the jury believed that he really felt he was in deadly harm, but that just proves that that's a bad law because, and I have some other numbers to give you later on, but that proves it's a bad law. But my question is, if Trayvon was your son, and the incidents that you knew happened today, I don't know. And before you answer, I'm going to have to bring in 404. I don't know that you could possibly feel the same way. And when it comes to folks like myself, why it hits home is because the mere fact that I'm a professional, I'm degreed, I have a business, I've written a book or a couple of books, I've done a whole lot of these things. And when I go into the store, I've done all the things that the American dream said you're supposed to do. I love, but when I go into the store today, I'm still trailed, and all of that drops right back into that feeling that every person who empathizes with that type of condition saw in regards to that. But I'm going to let you think and brew on that and bring in 404, and then we can continue with that. And by the way, folks, listen to the tone of our conversation. We want to get into people's minds, understand what's going on. We don't want people to come on here and shout or anything like that. We want to have a discussion. All things are not going to be resolved, but believe it or not, after you get into these conversations, when you're sleeping at night, your mind continues to work, and a lot of times you process things otherwise. Thank you, Bob. But let me get to 404, and we'll continue with you. 404, you are on. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Robert Rodriguez, gentlemen. Good afternoon.
Robert Rodrigo, talk to me, my brother.
Well, I'm discouraged that I can't yell now. You shouldn't have said that.
No, you can't yell.
Okay. Guys, come on. Nice to see you back on the show, Bob. I enjoyed your first time through. That was great.
Thanks.
I'll start here, I guess. One of the things, I have been very quiet about this whole affair, kind of watching it from afar. I didn't watch the trial, didn't watch a second of it. I haven't watched a second of the media coverage of it, and I'm talking about during the trial. Prior to and when the incident happened, you know, I saw it. But here's a couple of things I want to point out. First of all, I can tell you that my son is not allowed to have any hoodies in his life because I'm not going to deal with that. And I'm not, you know, he's not a black child. Pointing to be quiet, please. But he's not going to be walking around any of the neighborhoods in my area with a hoodie on because the perception is, not the perception. There is profiling in this country, period. It is ludicrous, in my view, and I'm not trying to insult anybody, but to me it is beyond reasonable for anybody to say that there's no profiling in this country, and it isn't even about necessarily an ethnicity, because we all know I hate the word race, because to me there's only one race, and we love to profile. But I'd like to point a couple of things out of some of the points that both of you have raised. First of all, you guys have been talking about the Stand Your Ground law, and while it is prominent in this case from the standpoint of it being a discussion, even to the point where people are now talking about boycotting the state, the Stand Your Ground law was not the element of the was not involved in the trial. It was rejected
Good
as
point.
A defense in this case. And so we've just gone through, for example, Bob and both of you guys were giving a description of what the law says about the Stand Your Ground law, but it's not relevant to this issue. It might be relevant to a scenario, but to this
thanks.
Issue, it's not
Robert,
relevant.
Robert, you are so right, and I kind of got off track, and thanks for putting that into perspective. Continue, please.
The next thing is in my view, I dispute what Bob said earlier about the trial that would be happening. Now, while I do agree that a lot of this was in regard to political pressure, and I do agree that evidence was limited from the standpoint of being circumstantial, I think he was charged wrong. I do not believe that there was an element at any time in this case that would allow for the charge of second-degree murder to be sustained, period. In my view,
that's absolutely correct.
Yes. In my view, from the standpoint of evidentiary issues and elements of crimes, the charges that should have been, one of the charges should have been, and maybe I will put it, I don't want to say the most severe charge. That's not my thought process. But from the standpoint of what was described to have had happened, it should have been a manslaughter charge. And there should have been other peripheral charges around it. I believe that, number one, Zimmerman had the right to protect himself when it comes to self-defense, according to the evidence that was presented. Number two is I believe that Zimmerman has responsibility in creating the event by his actions of following the person around and not listening to the dispatcher who told him not to do that. He has no business doing what he did. And so while his individual action does not necessarily create a crime, it creates a situation that led to a crime. And all of those
Bobby,
things are
Bobby. I have, you know something, what you know what you've just done there, and 210, I see you, I'll be coming to you next. I think you've just encapsulated perfectly something that I have been very poor in articulating. And thank you. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. You are saying that given the damage that we saw, which there wasn't all that much damage, but the damage that we saw on Zimmerman's face, conceivably it could be that there was a struggle and that at some point he felt in danger. But the reality that an innocent person who was walking and had Zimmerman not profiled him would be alive today because he did nothing illegal. The mere fact that he caused his death, it is manslaughter. After all, if you're drinking and you drive a car and you hit somebody, you didn't mean to do it. You didn't even half the times know that you did it, but you're charged with manslaughter. So I think that argument that you've just made there would have been the best argument for most people who thought Zimmerman got off. Really needs to be made. Let Bob respond, because I think your point came across. Respond to that, Bob.
Yeah, Robert, I think that you're right in that the prosecution was overzealous in how they charged the case. It should have never been a second-degree murder case. A charge of manslaughter would, if you were going to bring a cause of action against Zimmerman, that would be the proper level. And the result would have been the same, in that the self-defense argument would have probably come out and ruled him not guilty again. Zimmerman made a serious mistake that night. Zimmerman should have never gotten out of his car. He put himself in danger, and he put himself in a situation that he shouldn't have been in as a neighborhood watch person. His job was to watch, not to engage. And as far as disregarding dispatcher instructions, people know the reality of where they live. People know that what the response times of police departments are and how long it takes, and they get frustrated with how long it takes for a response time.
Let me stop there, though. It's important to, when you say that, I've heard this argument before. I was just engaged in it. So just give me 1 second to point out something you just said. What is important to remember here, which I didn't say earlier, I hadn't gotten to it yet, is that, and Egberto touched on this earlier, what is important to remember here is that the reason that I don't think that he does get acquitted if the manslaughter approach is done is because during the entire process, Trayvon Martin was not committing any crimes. So regardless of the fact that people know their neighborhoods, he still was never committing a crime. So there is no reality of what the neighborhood is. All it was is, as you point out, a watch. That's what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You have no, I don't know, a right is not the word I want, but you have no business doing that from the standpoint of society, to do anything that creates more of a situation when the person is not doing anything wrong. Now, if he breaks into a house, if he jumps on somebody or whatever, that's different. That's a real important thing here. Mm-hmm. The entire time, Trayvon Martin was not committing a crime.
Bobby, let me go up until
the point that he broke Zimmerman's nose. At that point, he committed assault. And when Zimmerman's head on a concrete curb, that is aggravated assault.
You were talking about
He never should have gotten out of the car. But getting out of the car didn't cause Trayvon to get shot.
But wait a minute. Let me get in a second. I need to get in here.
This guy is what caused that.
Okay, moderator, getting in. Here's the deal. and this is where I want to hit you, Bob. And it goes this way. Remember that the previous example that I gave. You and I are fighting, and because I started the fight with you. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I started the fight with you. You started to beat me because I started the fight with you. And then when you're beating me and I'm on the ground losing, I shoot you. That, if the law justifies that as you assaulting me, then the law is constitutional.
In those set of circumstances that you just described, that is not self-defense. If I come to you, I'm mad at you about something, and I bring a gun with me, and I start a fight with you, I hit you, I physically touch you, I hit you, throw you to the ground, something like that, and then I end up losing the fight, and so I grab my gun and use that in quote-unquote self-defense, that's not self-defense. But that's not what the evidence of this case supports.
Bob, and here's the deal. The evidence could not possibly be conclusive that is not the case, because everything shows that Zimmerman was the person who trailed him, was the person who followed him. I don't know about you, but if I'm walking down in Kingwood and there's somebody in a car following me, and I get into a position, I am likely to, well, now I'm likely to just probably run and hide, because it's like I know that my life is in danger, and everybody who's like me, and this, I'm not being silly here. To a lot of people who look like me, really, and you know, folks may, you're that's not the case. A lot of folks that look like me look at life differently post Trayvon Martin's trial, because we know now that juries will still, no matter the consequences, would still find a way to justify what their preconceived notions are. I have two more calls ahead, Bob, and stay with me, because this is going just fine. But I want to tell you guys,
thing, if you don't mind,
quickly, Bob.
Let me just say one thing real quick. Bob had mentioned earlier about people know their neighborhoods, and then you brought up this example. And that's the other thing I wanted to point out. There are two people in that altercation that know their neighborhoods. When I hear the argument or the debate that, you know, Zimmerman got out of his car or anything that he was doing because he knows the neighborhood, well, Trayvon Martin lived in the same neighborhood, and he knows his neighborhood when people try and follow him or something, like you were just pointing out. So there are two factors here. We did not have the benefit of testimony from the person who died. So there's a big hole in the scenario. I do believe Zimmerman should be allowed to defend himself. Absolutely. I think human beings should be able to do that. I just find it interesting that from an ideological standpoint, that we always find from the progressive liberal side seeing it one way only, and the conservative side seeing it the other way only, and it's
that,
there's not.
Bob,
it's
that's why I mean, Robert.
Board.
That's why I wanted to have Bob here, because I wanted Bob to hear a point of view, and I really wanted to hear what he was thinking, because coming from my point of view, it's like, how can you possibly see a dead 17-year-old and not feel like, you know, and that was followed, and not see the problem? And what happens, and a lot of times is, like I said, there was a concerted effort to demonize Trayvon, which mostly are lies. You can verify it at Snopes, but a lot of people don't want to see that. But we'll continue with that. I want to bring 210 in, and after 210-713, stay with me, guys. I'm leaving all of your mics hot so you can jump in, but let's make sure and keep it civil. 210-210, you are hot. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Yeah, it's John from San Antonio.
Hey, John,
always
how you doing?
Always a pleasure, Bertha.
Pleasure
I'm doing okay.
Right.
Yeah, but it's pretty disturbing to hear, you know, what Bob's saying. And let me just first start off by saying, you know, the greatest thing that could ever happen, you know, from this trial is if all of these stand your ground laws are repealed. And that's what we should be working for. And I disagree that politicians shouldn't be talking about this. I think you and Bob both agreed with that. I completely disagree with that. Politicians should be working to overturn stand your ground laws, all of them in every state, or try to get a federal law, making it outlawing it. That's obviously going to be very hard. Just like all of these, most of the stand your ground laws are in southern states, which have a history of racism, and there's no doubt that that's one of the reasons why this happened. And let's also talk about the fact that I think Robert was talking about the fact that they didn't use the stand your ground law as a defense, but it was a given as the instructions to the jury.
That
in
is
fact,
true.
The juror, whatever her name was, B37, who was absolutely, you know, horrible. In her opinion, it was just her racism was so blatant and so upfront that I couldn't even watch it. I mean, I was flipping channels and I was watching it, and she kept referring to George this and George that, and how George was, you know, within his rights. Stand your ground laws are terrible, because if you're a paranoid schizophrenic. You have a license to kill. Oh, my God, that person walking down the street, they're trying to kill me. I have
okay,
a mental illness.
Let's stop there. I need to interject some facts here. First off, the self-defense is not whether you believe that you were in imminent danger or not, but whether a reasonable person under the description of events.
No, it's not. That's not true. What it says is you feel
okay, let me correct,
you
wait,
as
let
a
me
person
correct, let me
wait,
correct
one
other fact here. Okay?
One at a time.
Wait,
one at a time.
Let me correct one other thing that you said is factually inaccurate. You said that stand your ground states are only in southern states with a history of racial discrimination, and that is just absolute false. There's
I didn't hear him
over
say
26
that.
States. He did say that. There are over 26 states that have stand your ground laws. California, Georgia, Maine,
I don't think that's right. I don't think California
well,
has a stand
right.
your ground law. I'll look
it
up
right,
right now.
Okay, let me get in here and say one thing. I need to get in and say one thing specifically. Here is the deal. When it comes to Stand Your Ground, after Stand Your Ground was adopted, the states that adopted Stand Your Ground, homicide rates went up by 8%. That's fact. FBI data, that's fact. So, I mean, we know that these laws are...
That's not fact.
Yes, it is. You can go and pull the data, and if you want, Bob, I'll pull
it
for you.
I'm looking at data right now that says the murder rates dropped by 9%, violent crime dropped by 11% in states that have doctrine laws.
That, let me tell you, a homicide is defined as somebody killing somebody else. Didn't, you know? It, in other words, we have to be careful with how we actually interpret data, and that's why we have to interpret data honestly. Homicide means one human being killing another human being. And what we've said
correct.
Is that the killing of human beings increased with Stand Your Ground laws. Killing human beings increased with Stand Your Ground laws. We're going to continue this, but I have a 713 holding, and I don't want to keep somebody holding too long, but we have time to discuss all of this in detail. 713, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Peggy in Houston.
Peggy, how are you doing,
Peggy?
I'm good, thank you. First, I would like to hear Bob finish what he was going to say about George Zimmerman knowing his neighborhood. I'm assuming he was going to say that's why he got out of the car early. Is that correct, Bob?
What I meant by knowing his neighborhood is he knows how long it takes the police to respond to something. He also, the fact, there's a discussion that Trayvon Martin lived there. He didn't live there, or if he did, he was a new resident there because he had just recently started staying there. That said, I've been in situations on the freeway where I see someone who's a dangerous drunk driver on the road. And I call 911 to report this person because they're weaving, they're putting everybody's lives in danger. And the dispatcher says, okay, we've got your location, we don't need you to follow them. Well, I know that a car on a moving freeway is going to take a long time for the police to respond to it, especially if they don't have updates as to the location of the car. And so I made a decision to stay with it and to stay with the dispatcher and keep them up to date on where the car was so they could get it pulled over. And if there was an accident, that there would be a witness that the person had been driving a long way under obvious influence of something. So you as the individual who sees something going on, whether it's a crime or whether you are just suspicious of something, are not under an obligation to not follow or not watch and
right.
observe what's going on.
Are
so,
you saying that's an excuse for George to engage with
George
Trayvon?
Should have never engaged with the person. George should have never gotten out of his car. George should have never walked up to Trayvon. Testimony says that he didn't walk up to Trayvon, that Trayvon walked up to him. But that's one side of the story, and we'll never hear the other side of the story. But Trayvon or George Zimmerman should have never gotten out of his car, should have never engaged the person. He should have just kept him in sight until the police arrived.
Let me ask you this. Peggy, did you want to say something else?
Well, yes. My observation is that both these individuals were in fear because of their situation. And I know we're talking legal facts and all of this kind of stuff, but the continued angst and discussion that people are still experiencing, it's more than just the legal fact. It's the emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotion is based on fear. And I think if we're why this is happening, why we're still having this discussion, is because there is an existential reason that we're supposed to go to the root cause to address this fear.
Thank you.
The fear in this issue. And that is emotion and spiritual. And there is a root cause, and it's very, very old, and it goes way before the times of slavery in America. But it's
an issue
that is just as emotional as it is legal. And that's why we still have the argument. And I know that's very frustrating for people that don't want to see the emotion of the issue. But that's why there's still a discussion.
Now, when you say the problem, so what is the problem as you see it?
Well, this could really digress the conversation and really alienate perhaps some of your viewers.
That's what we want.
Okay. Well, the forced discord between the races is manufactured, as some of us suspect. But it's manufactured for a reason, and it's manufactured by a certain body of people who want to control the world, basically. And they have to create this discord in order to do it. And for all the people that are arguing back and forth and arguing all the legal stuff and all the minutia, they don't realize that they are being played.
Please keep on, Peggy. I've written that before, but I really want to hear specifically now your continuation, because you are preaching something that I have written with regards to the fallacy of racial differences, etc., being used to play us against each other so that we don't look at the real problem. And the problem that I describe it as is the real plutocracy. But please move on.
Well, I could go on and on about this, what people call a conspiracy theory, and there's a lot of tentacles that are part of this octopus, as one author calls it. However, the root of it all that I found in some very recent research is that Jesus was black, and that this group that wants to hide the fact, they want to hide that fact so that they can repress a certain segment of the human race that is existentially and spiritually quite advanced and has been on this planet actually a lot longer than a lot of the other races within our human genome, if that's the right term. But the only way you can get total control of the world is through monetary means, of course, but also you have to oppress the spiritual, the true spiritual nature of the human being. And that's the 90% of the brain that we don't use ostensibly.
Now, let me tell you, Peggy, I only like to deal in the portions of things that I can factually ascertain. With respect to Jesus and all of that, the truth of the matter is, personally, I don't care what race Jesus is or whatever. From a scientific point of view, there's one thing we know, and that is that the human race, meaning black, white, whatever else you want to call race, whatever it is, all had one distinct origin, and I think that can be proven. So I don't give a lot of credence to anything racial per se. I do, but empirically, I give credence to knowing that I'm profiled, et cetera, et cetera, for reasons that are embedded in the minds of folks in order to capitalize on division to ensure that a select few, and that select few doesn't necessarily have to be of one particular race, and that is, but that's another subject. I want to bring in another caller, and then we'll continue on the particular issue that we're really talking about, and that's the Trevon case. I think this is a Skype caller, so if you just heard us say you're hot, please come on in and give me your name.
Yeah, my name's Joe.
So hi, Joe. How are you doing today?
How you doing? I'm here to listen to the debate between the liberal and the conservative discussing the Zimmerman case. So has that debate started? Has it ended? What's going on?
No, that's what we're talking. We're talking about how people view the Trevon Martin case, and in a lot of ways from a racial standpoint, and I'd like to hear your point of view.
Well, it could have been racial, just because the evidence wasn't definitive that was introduced into the case, or actually it wasn't introduced, doesn't mean it didn't have a racial component. Racial component, rather. But the thing is it may have been racial, it may not have been racial. You're talking about, I presume, the New World Order, which is an organization or at least some sort of movement which has an agenda to divide the United States. So if you're talking about that, then I guess the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case would have to be part of that, even if indirectly. But my particular viewpoint was that morally justice was not done. Legally it was. I personally, if I'm going to be followed by somebody and I don't know who that person is, the person doesn't have on a uniform, person doesn't have a badge, the person gets out of the car, and then as I'm talking to him, even though I may confront him first, he reaches into his back pocket, I am not going to stand around to wait to see if he's got a gun or a knife. I'm going to knock the guy out. So I think the law has to include what happens when there's a confrontation and when there is even a semblance of some sort of aggression.
Now, you see, Joe, that is where I agree with you, and that is what's most concerning with me. You know, in as much as Bob says, well, Trevon may have been beating the crap out of Zimmerman, mm-hmm. The reality is, the reason I asked Bob is if I confront Bob and out of fear Bob starts beating the crap out of me and then I shoot Bob, and Bob agrees with me actually. Bob says, no, that would be murder. And I am telling Bob that there's no evidence that says that's not what occurred. But if you follow by inference how he was followed, what he thought about these guys in these hoodies that are, they always get away and that sort of thing, I think he laid the groundwork for a confrontation. I personally think Zimmerman laid the groundwork for a confrontation, and it was all there. And I know there are many people who are, they want to start the discussion at Zimmerman supposedly being on the ground. Well, yes, his clothes were wet, which means his back was really in the grass. But then we don't know if he is. I mean, the guy knows the law. We don't know that he did drag himself in the grass to make the evidence. I mean, there are a lot that we don't know. The only thing that we know for sure, is that Zimmerman followed ultimately followed an innocent man, and out of a what seemed to have possibly been a confrontation. We don't know if Zimmerman punched himself. We don't know if Zimmerman hit himself on the ground. There was no blood marks on the concrete or anything
wait,
like that.
Wait,
we don't know
what
happened.
We do know that. Witnesses testified to Trayvon being on top of Zimmerman and pounding
him
into the ground.
No, they did not. They did not. Nobody saw what went on. That's a lie. That's
no, there was a witness called John Good. He testified that he saw Trayvon Martin on top of Zimmerman. He did not testify that he was hitting him, but he said by inference that he probably was through the ground and pound and through his arms
and
flailing through the air.
And here's the other thing that was said in the trial. The other thing that was said in the trial is that there was yet another woman that came out and said the opposite. She said that Zimmerman was on top of Trayvon. So, I mean, those two arguments should have squashed themselves. Like I said, the only thing that I know, if I am walking in my neighborhood, folks, if I am walking in my neighborhood and somebody is following me, I know that at that point I have no recourse.
Wait, you have no recourse for what? You have no
about
recourse
anything.
For what?
It does. I have
you
zero
do have
recourse.
Recourse. I mean, it's, here, let me just, we're all, we've been throwing out, we've been throwing out hypotheticals here. Let me throw out a hypothetical about how this could have gone in a much better way. Zimmerman made a mistake in getting out of his car, walking along. He says he turned around and started to go back, and then Trayvon jumped out from behind a tree or a bush or whatever and confronted him and said, "Do you have a problem?" And Zimmerman said, "No," and then he said, "Well, you do now," and hit him in the nose. Okay, fine. Let's say that conversation went differently. Let Bob finish, and then I'm just talking in generics, not specific facts here. Let's say that that went differently. Let's say Trayvon comes up and says, "Why are you following me?" And Zimmerman says, "I'm with the local neighborhood watch organization. I don't recognize you. Where are you from? Where are you headed?" And Trayvon says, "Oh, I'm staying with my dad down the street. I'm just headed home." Conversation's over. Everybody goes home. The whole world is different. But go back to what Peggy said, and that both of those guys were operating out of fear. Zimmerman was afraid because he saw somebody in his neighborhood, didn't recognize him. There's been a history of crimes in the neighborhood. He wanted to do something about it. He was in fear. Trayvon Martin is in fear because some crazy-ass cracker is following him, and he doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know if the guy's going to try to hurt him. He doesn't know what's going to happen. So he reacts in fear. If both of those people had just had a reasonable conversation with each other, much like we have the luxury of doing here over the phone, the outcome of that trial would have been completely different. But somebody broke the law. Somebody created a physical assault against the other. And at that point, we can only go by evidence, and the evidence sustains that Zimmerman was not guilty. But going back to the
root cause, I don't
agree
that the evidence says that at all, but that's fine. We can disagree on what the evidence says. But Mike, and I asked you a personal question before, Bob, and that is, if Trayvon was your kid, under the same circumstances that occur, what would you have thought about it then? And you see, what has happened a lot in this case, and I'll just say it. Remember, we can say as we please because we don't want to be prejudged here on this show. But I think there are, I think, honestly, Bob, you are unable to empathize with Trayvon being your son. And I think that's my personal opinion about how you are sterilizing.
I don't think that's accurate. I do empathize with him, and if I was a parent of him, I would be very hurt, and I would be wanting to get to the bottom of exactly what happened, and I would want to try to make sure that something like that never happened again to anybody else's son. And to those aspects, I think what the Martin family is doing is admirable, and that they haven't really blown this thing up in the way that they could have, or in the way that some people might have taken it a different way. But they've tried to find, they asked for a day in court, and they got their day in court. Now they're not satisfied with that, and that's fine. I wouldn't probably be satisfied with it either. I'd want to make sure that something like that didn't happen again. And part of that discussion has to be, how do we get people to come together and talk in a nonviolent way, and talk with each other in a non-fear-based way, so that things don't blow up and things don't get escalated out of proportion.
I agree, but
was
Bob,
wrong. He shouldn't have followed the guy.
But here's
if,
the problem.
If the facts are right that Trayvon punched him, he shouldn't have done that either.
But so. Bob, here's the problem that with the whole situation here. And then 401, I'm coming to you. Here's the problem with that, Bob. The problem is that absent that stand your ground law that, in as much as it wasn't used in the trial proper, absent that law, given that it was evident that Zimmerman knew the law, it's very likely that the behavior would have been different on Zimmerman's part. He would, because knowing machismo, knowing that he has that gun and he has the right to stand your ground, he doesn't have a problem in confronting. And that's when Bobby Rodrigo talks about...
Let me address that as a guy that carries a gun.
No. I'm going to let you address that after.
Let me address that from that perspective, because when I'm carrying a concealed weapon, I go out of my way to make sure I'm never put in a situation where I'm going to have to use it. I will walk away from things that I might not otherwise walk away from because of the fact that I'm carrying a gun. I don't want to get in a situation where I'm ever going to have to use it. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm being an aggressor.
Bob,
yes.
Bob, but that's not what he did. He put himself in a condition where he may have had to use it, and he did.
And he did,
but
I have said that he was wrong in doing that.
Okay, good. Let me get to 401. 401, you are hot. Who do I have the honor of speaking to? 401.
Hello, my name is Jason. I'm just a first-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you very much, Jason, for calling, and I hope you come back. Make your point, my dear friend.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, as a young black man who kind of falls, I guess, squarely into the demographic that Trayvon did, I'm definitely, like, in full support and for, you know, the argument that's been stirred up the last couple of weeks about blacks being stereotyped and that being the reason why the situation between Zimmerman and Trayvon happened. I mean, I can personally speak to that. I mean, as a black man, I've had the same things that Obama said about people locking their car doors. I've seen women get out of cars and get back into the car as they saw me walk by. I've had people get off of elevators as I stepped on. I've had, move into a majority white suburb and walking down the street, have people stare at you. Never get invited to the cookout, never get invited to anything that happens in the neighborhood, and just this constant social isolation from a lot of white people because of their fears based on stereotypes. And those kind of fears do create that Zimmerman type of situation. So when people say that, you know, there's nothing, we have no argument, we have no basis or anything like that, I just say, you know, walk in our shoes, because for someone like me, like, I'm not a big guy. I'm not a physically imposing guy. I'm 5'6", 5'7", maybe. So for people to sit there and look at someone like me and feel afraid or feel like, you know, I may do something to them, it can only really be based on race, because there's really no logic in thinking that someone who's 5'7" and 150 pounds could attack someone that's twice their size and get away with it. So when people say that, you know, oh, there is no stereotyping, there is no profiling or anything like that, I'm sorry, but you're wrong.
Jason, what I would love to, I'm going to bring it back in a second. What I would love to, one of the reasons I like out of a program like this is I have a, you know, I live in a white neighborhood as well. And a lot of my white friends would tell me they understand the situation. And not only do they understand the situation, some of them have even had that visceral reaction that you speak about. And some have sat me down and said, I'll be honest with you, Egberto, that is what happened because that is how I was conditioned. In other words, they were conditioned to have a visceral reaction to people that look like me. Now that I tell you a better story, this is a better story. As you know, as a member of Coffee Party, we try to maintain a certain level of civility in the way we discuss through all party lines and through all these different lines. But there was one particular time on the radio, I was speaking to a person, and I control myself no matter what you say very well on the radio. I never go crazy like Limbaugh or anything like that. But I remember one time I raised my voice and I told a person, you know, how wrong they were. And one of my listeners called me on my cell phone and said, wow, Egberto, I had never heard you that mad, or I don't remember the word that they used, but it was interesting because I went back and I listened to the show to see if, you know, maybe I had come across wild or crazy, and it was nowhere close to Sean Hannity, nowhere close to Rush Limbaugh, nowhere close to any of these guys that you may hear, you know, going crazy on the phone. But that person having an association with me and then having me have an expressive reaction changed the persona that they had of me, because I think I may have come across initially like that different black person that always stays calm. In other words, as you know, Jason, many times we are forced to be calmer than the other,
and we should have
less reactive than the other. And I've told a lot of my friends that I said many times, whenever I go into a certain domain, I act accordingly, and I try to make myself as non-threatening as possible. It's not really my problem, but it gets people to first listen. Because
right.
if I'm first go with that way of being, then I have to first overcome that. So I'm glad that you called. And so continue, Jason, and then I want to add a little thing after that.
Yeah, I also just want to piggyback off of that. It doesn't even have to be that big of an event. It can be something as simple as walking into a restaurant and you get seated in a certain waiter's area and you can see them rolling their eyes from a distance because they have this, you know, the stereotype about us. I mean, I worked in a restaurant, and just let me say, I'm personally of a lighter complexion. So
right.
people mistake me for actually being Hispanic. So what
right.
happens is, in a lot of cases, being surrounded by whites, they forget that you are black or don't know at all, and they start
right.
to slip and say racist things, just outright racist things about black people altogether. So when I worked in a restaurant, when a black table would come in, there would be waiters and waitresses just outright saying, oh my God, those effing you-know-whats, or eggplant, or just something really, really racist. And, you know, just complaining, oh, they're not going to leave me a tip, they're rude, they're loud, you know, just all these really stupid stereotypes. And, I mean, I've been in a situation where I, not working, just going into a restaurant, have gone in, and you get the eye roll, and then once the check comes and you leave the person a big tip, a guy actually stopped me as I was walking out the door, and he damn near bowed to me. He was like, thank you. He was like, you don't know how much you made my day because I left them a big tip. And he probably assumed that I wasn't going to leave him anything. And that's
right.
what I'm saying. Like, white people are not, they don't have to deal with things like that. They don't have to deal with crappy service from people in a restaurant or a hotel or a bar or anywhere like that, because someone's going to automatically assume that you're not going to leave them money or you're going to.
And
be
I think
rude.
That is what's important. And Jason, what I wish, and this is one of the reasons I had to call this show, I think it is okay for everybody, white folks included, to have preconceived misconceptions. But we only change when you acknowledge that those problems exist. In other words, you and I, maybe the two only blacks on the phone right now on this show, there are several of us on the phone, experience that. We're professionals.
Right.
We experience that. It doesn't matter what has happened. The only thing that matters in this regard is in certain instances, because of how we look, it's how we're profiled. 724, I'm coming to you next, but I think Bob said he wanted to respond. Bob.
Yeah, I have a similar place to relate to what you're saying. When I was in the military serving overseas, you know, there was blatant discrimination against me because I was an American. And you would get it walking down the street, you know, people would mutter under their breath, or they'd, you know, look at you with a dirty look or something just because of the stereotype of who I was or who they thought I was and not me as an individual. So I'm going to say that this is on a smaller scale than what blacks in America have had to deal with in their life growing up. But I do have a basis point for relating to this. And even in the United States, as a veteran during the 70s, when I would be in town you know, military people were not popular at that point in time, and we were the subject of discrimination, the subject of various stereotyping and attacks and things like that. So I do have a basis to have an empathy and an understanding of exactly what
and
you're
Bob, and what
about.
I'm saying, because you have that, and I think I honestly think I see that in the conversations we've had and in being together in Austin and Houston and all these other places on the same venues, that. But I'm going to add one caveat to that, Bob. I think you have a responsibility as a conservative to actually call out a lot of what occurs under that mantra that, you know, I read your site all the time or whatever, that I think you're not yet doing. And I would hope that you would. But let me get...
Well, I think I do that on... Let me respond to that. I think I do
okay,
that
go ahead,
on some occasions. Maybe I don't do it as often as I should or as much as I could. And I would like some feedback from you from time to time if you think there's some place where I need to be pointing out that kind of bias in people. Because I don't like it, I don't tolerate it, and I don't want anything to do with it. I don't think it reflects well on our political party. I don't think it reflects well on our people as Americans. And I think we need to deal with those issues and deal with them realistically and talk about them. And you know, it's why I've been so active in the immigration and trying to get immigration reform and that confronting people about their fears of change in this country. A lot of that resistance to the immigration reform is because people are afraid of change. They're afraid that the world as they know it is not going to be the same. Well, the world's never the same. The world is always going to change, and we have to adapt and move forward with it and try to make it work the best way we can. So I will continue to try to point out those things, but if you ever see some place where you think I'm not, I would appreciate the feedback on it.
Well, excellent. We'll do that. We'll do that on both sides. And by the way, folks, for the ad that I did for this show, Bob's website is there. Please give him a holler and leave him some messages as well, civil, of course, and you know, talk to him because, like I said, our guy, Bob Price here, is a good man. He's conservative, but he's good. Come on, Bob. You know I had to say that. All right, 724.
And that's why I like coming back here, because you are fair.
All right, 724, you're on.
Hi, Egberto. This is Greg in Pittsburgh. It's a great show today.
Hey,
and,
Greg, how you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Talk to
you. I want to congratulate Bob, actually, for being here and for and really being a thoughtful and rational conversationalist and everything, even when, you know, it does seem to me so far that he's on his own right now. There's not too many folks that are kind of taking Bob's side on a lot of this, but to that, I would say I am taking Bob's side in so much as I'm glad to hear him say that Zimmerman really made a mistake in getting out of the car. I mean, I don't think it would be too hard to envision a much different scenario in all of this had George just not gotten out of the car.
Right.
You know, it would seem to me that had he stayed in the car, Trayvon Martin doesn't circle back if that's in fact what he did. Everything else we've talked about so far in this whole case probably never happens. And I don't mind the idea that George is concerned about his neighborhood. I applaud that as well. It's the judgment that he used past that. And there's undoubtedly myriad reasons why he did it, and we may never actually understand or know because we can't be in his head. We can't be in his heart. We don't know why George did what he did, if it was out of fear, if it was out of anger, frustration, racial profiling, the fact that Trayvon was wearing a hoodie. You know, we will undoubtedly never really know the truth. But there are a couple of things that I would say in relation to the conversation around what you and the other caller were talking about. I'm sorry, I forgot his name. The other
Jason. The other
Jason,
black person,
you.
Jason.
Yes, Jason. You guys, I just learned this term this week, actually, and it was just something I heard on Marketplace. It's a National Public Radio program. It's called a respectability tax. And it was a really interesting story, and I'll share the URL with you at some point somehow. But the whole idea that as an African-American, especially as an African-American man, you have to take a different tact and a different tone simply and only because of the color of your skin. And that is rooted in the racism that still exists in this country. It's not as blatant as it once was, but it still exists. And the fact that you feel that way, that I could call into your show and rant and rave, and no one would think a thing of it, except that maybe this guy's a lunatic. But if you do it, you are a danger to society. And I'll make one final point on that, and then you know I'd love to hear everyone else's thoughts. Imagine, if you will, a group of African Americans marching in protest with a sign that says, "We came unarmed this time." The Tea Party has done that repeatedly.
Right.
And those are not black faces. Those are white faces.
Can I make a response to that?
Please.
Please do.
I agree with what you're saying. And also just to build upon that, I mean, when you say that, you made the point about someone raising their voice and just being, like you said, considered a lunatic and everyone ignoring them. That's another issue, is just that everyone sort of considers all black people to just be a monolith. When a black person acts up or acts, you know, stupidly, we all get blamed for that.
Right.
We all get stereotyped as part of that group. Whereas, you know, when another black person does something well, we don't get stereotyped as that. So the positive side of our communities and of our people never get highlighted, whereas the negative sides of us always do, you know. So people put their, you know, they always throw up this kind of smokescreen argument about, well, black men commit a disproportionate amount of crime. Well, that may be true, but you also have taken, there's a truth that supersedes that truth, which is that most black men don't actually commit crime at all. So for you to say that, you know, black men are committing crime and this and that, it's just fear based on, you know, the stereotypes that you believe. So I just feel a certain way about that. I feel strongly about it because, like I said, I have to deal with that every day. I have to deal with people looking at me strangely or just, you know, wanting to be, you know, not wanting to be near you. You know what I mean? It's just when you see people,
you know,
using
Jason,
that as a basis for argument. I just want to make this last point. When you want to make that as a basis for argument, it's like, but we as black people could do the same thing. We could say that the majority of meth addicts and meth dealers are white. Therefore, we get to profile every single white person as a meth addict, but we don't. You know what I mean? But they get to use that as an argument against us, and I just feel strongly about that.
Could I add one more thing, Egberto, to what Jason
please
said?
Please do. Please do.
Greg. And Bob, I'm not picking on you, but this goes right back to something that you were saying earlier. Your experiences in what you felt were some sort of mistreatment by society, wherever you were stationed in the military, and thank you for your service, does not compare at all.
Oh, I understand that, and I stated that what I went through is minuscule in comparison to what, you know, the average black person may face
right,
in this country.
Right. Well, I'm glad you did, because you and I as old white guys don't have any idea. We don't have a legitimate leg to stand on in that part of this conversation. We just don't.
But you know what, Greg, Bob, and every white person on this show, one thing you can do after information is laden out there is empathize. And one of the things, and I think I told Bob as well, is change occurs not when I constantly or Jason says these things happen, but it occurs when folks like you who can empathize and actually have the real ear of people when I am not around, when Jason is not around, who can actually say, hey, technically speaking, we need to really get over some of the preconceived notions that we have, because it's not really so. Jason said a very important point. Jason said that, the notion that the crime rate on a percentage basis is much higher for black men, that is true. What isn't said is that the poverty rate among that same group is much higher than the general population. What isn't said is that that poverty rate, a lot of it not because of the not causal because of being black, but because of society proper, causes that, when I say causes that violence, I don't want to make it an excuse for the violence. But let's give an example. Let's use me as an example. I have a strong head. Jason has a strong head. every turn that I make that, you know, outside of those who know me in my community, every turn that I make to have to be prejudged, how many people do you know throw their hands up and say, well, you know what? It's a lot easier, since I'm being prejudged, why not just have a reason to be prejudged?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of people could take those kinds of stances. But
a lot of people do. A lot of people do. They just get frustrated with the constant being told what they are when they know that they are not. And they stop trying after a while.
Exactly. Who said Egberta? Come on in.
That was Bob. I'd like to, I don't know how much time we have left here, but I'd like to kind of move forward to a different topic of being the protests that are going on this weekend. Okay,
we were supposed to talk about that as well. Go ahead.
Yeah. This weekend all across the country, there are protests coming out on both sides of this discussion and viewpoints. And I'm very concerned because it's so emotionally charged on both sides that there's a potential for violent activity to occur. And I want to have a talk about that and strongly encourage anyone that might be listening or anyone that might be participating in any of these events to just be out there to express your First Amendment right. Just, you know, say what you want to say and express yourself peacefully in the manner of Martin Luther King and have a peaceful protest. But don't let either side goad you or push you into doing something that will cause violence and will cause negative impact on what you're trying to accomplish.
Amen, Bob.
Berto, can I jump in here, please?
Please do, please do.
First thing I'd like to say is that, as usual, there is a very thoughtful, wonderful group of people having a discussion on your show. I just want to put that out there real quick. Thank you, Bob, for saying that. I want to comment on a couple of across the board of what's been going on. First of all, I would say Greg made a comment about how racism is not as prevalent as it was in recent years, and I actually am getting to the point where I don't agree with that anymore, and I'll give you my basis for it. And I just think that it's not prevalent in the sense that people aren't being hung in the streets. But, you know, I'm 51 years old. Some of you are older than I am. Some of you are younger. But in my generation, there has been an immense amount of racist atrocities. I was born in 1962, and there's been an immense amount of racist atrocities within this country. And while a lot of the violence is gone, the actual racism still exists. Two examples I can give you. The first Mike Tyson Evander Holyfield fight, I was living in Aurora, Colorado, and we were having a group over to watch the fight. And one of our friends was a black and white couple. The gentleman was black and the woman was white, and they lived in Aurora like the rest of us did. And they were on their way to the fight, and they got pulled over by the Aurora Police Department. And the Aurora Police Department, this is whatever year it was, I want to say it was 91, 92, something like that. The Aurora Police Department actually had the audacity to go up to my friend Steve's wife and ask her if she was okay because she was in the car with a black man. Okay? If you think of what I just described to you, if you put yourself in that position, it is an unimaginable that thought process in my mind going across somebody. Now I'm 6'4". I'm an offensive lineman. I am Spanish and Italian. I look like 18 different ethnic origins. When I lived in California, they could never figure out what I was. and my son is Spanish and Italian and black. So I get all of this, and yet my son is an American. That's what he is. And one of the things that I offer here as a solution is to drop the caveat. I've said this before. My son is not an African American. He's not an Italian American. He's not a Spanish American. He's an American. He's born in the United States of America. That's what he is. He's an American. We are the only country in the world that does that. You want to talk about division. We also have political parties which shouldn't even be, to me, it's ludicrous. We were talking about political parties in a sense, because we have a thought process involved here that is being run by people who lack credibility. For example, I do not think the Reverend Al Sharpton has any credibility to even open his mouth in public. I can't believe MSNBC had a show with him on it. That's my personal feeling. I also think the same thing about Ann Coulter, and the list is long and distinguished. Our 1% media formulates our arguments. If we treat each other with based on merit and colorblind, we do so much better. I'm sure all of you saw during the NBA playoffs and now during the Major League All-Star game, the racist responses to the Spanish kid who sang, American child who was of ethnic background of Spanish in San Antonio, who sang the national anthem at the Spurs game, and Mark Anthony, who is an American, who sang God Bless America at the Citi Field in the All-Star game. The response to them, which is my second example of why I think racism is still as prevalent in our society, just from a nonviolent standpoint. And Bob's request that we remain civil and nonviolent is so important because it's there. I live in Georgia. It's there. I see it every single day. I see ethnic hatred, period. It's there.
Now,
keep it in a bubble.
Robert, I agree with you,
right?
Can
I say something, Alberto?
Okay, please do.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a different view from what Bob was saying. We've had there have been protests, you know, from Saturday night on, and they've been civil. There have been very, very few. There have been, you know, maybe a handful of violent acts, and so
Jason,
today.
I agree with you.
Make my point. Don't cut me off now. So to say, okay, now the Tea Party activists are coming in and there could be a confrontation. This is exactly what Fox News and talk radio was talking about. They were talking about race riots and all this, you know, mayhem and chaos that was going to happen if this jury found Zimmerman innocent. And they didn't happen. And so I think this is just more of a similar reaction, what you're saying. I think your heart is in the right place. You genuinely don't want violence to happen. So I agree with you. But I think all you're doing is projecting your own fear. And I think the fact that you're projecting your own fear is that you know that there is that possibility because you know the mentality of the Tea Party.
That's not correct. All right, let me respond.
Well, that's the way I feel it. And if
right.
you look at the history, if you look at the last
let me respond
week,
to
there
what
hasn't
you just
been
said.
Okay, let him finish and then you
reaction.
Respond, Bob.
And also, I'd like to talk about Zimmerman himself. If I was on that jury, I wouldn't have believed one word that Zimmerman said. Nobody knew what went on nobody knew who instigated what kind of conversation went on. Nobody was there. Nobody was in the proximity. And so everything to believe Zimmerman after the dispatcher told him to not to do anything, to me, that gave away all of his credibility. I wouldn't believe one word he says. All he cared about was getting off. That's the only thing he cared about, and I would have never, ever believed him. And I also want to say about the actual law, I want to read what the actual law says. It says, this is the Florida law. It says, such force is so great that the person reasonably believes that he or she is in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm, and that he and she has exhausted, now this is the key, has exhausted every reasonable means to escape such danger other than the use of force, which is likely to cause death or great bodily harm to the assailant. Okay, are you telling me after the dispatcher told him don't confront him that he exhausted every reasonable means to escape such danger? Are you telling me that that's actually even conceivable? Why didn't he just say, okay, when the fight started, whoever started it, just say, okay, let's start talking about this. You know,
John,
I mean,
John, let me. Before I give Bob a chance to answer you, I'll tell you a lot of things that don't come out that really strikes me. Remember, Jason earlier said, I am not even a big guy. I'm 5'7 and 150. Guess what? Guess how big Trevon was? A little under 6 feet and a little over 150 pounds. And guess how big Zimmerman was? Over 200 pounds. So, I mean, let me finish, Bob, and then
It's not just that, too, but it's like we know there's clearly a difference between teenage strength and grown men strength.
Right.
So if you really believe that a teenager had the strength to just knock a grown man down, I mean, that says more about Zimmerman than it does about Trevon.
Exactly.
I mean, for anyone that just believe it, like, oh, okay, I'm 28 years old and a 17-year-old knocked me down with one punch. Like,
it's just not even believable. With bringing Rodrigo into the conversation, but making a point that he made, what happens is that people are predisposed, and this isn't just saying folks are bad or whatever. It's just that because of the conditioning, John, people are predisposed to accept that at face value, and people are predisposed to look at evidence. And to put it bluntly, if you looked at the case, even the prosecutors at some point adapted that as well. So, I mean, when Bob says that the right decision was made, I don't think the right decision was made, but plausibly speaking, based on conditioning, huh. But anyway, Bob, you wanted to respond.
Yeah, let me respond to two things before they get too far upstream and we can't bring them back. The issue about the protest this week and then what's different about the protest this weekend. It's not because there have been Tea Party protests all across the United States for years now, and there's never been any violent actions in any of those either. So just to say that there's a Tea Party mentality that's going to be violent, there's no basis in fact to support that. The reason I'm concerned is because anytime you bring two sides together that are highly emotional about their point, their the possibility.
You're breaking up, Bob.
Okay, let me move here. Last week in Austin, when Egberto and I were at the pro-life and the pro-choice rallies that were going on, there again, you had two groups of people who were highly charged and highly emotional, and they came together, and in some cases they actually intermingled amongst each other, but it stayed nonviolent, and that's where we need to make sure that it goes. You know, you saw people who were very passionate about expressing their views on life. You saw people who were very passionate in expressing their views on keeping the government out of things they didn't believe they should be involved in, but it stayed speech and not action, and that's what I'm talking about. To go back to the second point about the issue of self-defense, the key word in what you read there is reasonable. And reasonable is a term of art in the legal world that means what would a reasonable person think, not what do you reasonably think, what does a reasonable person think. And that is what a jury has to decide, is that's a reasonable response. Now, in the situation, there was another shooting, there was a high-profile self-defense shooting here in Houston that involved a man named Joe Horn, where he also disregarded what the police dispatchers told him, stepped outside of his house, was confronted by two burglars who had just come out of a neighbor's house, and he shot them. Legally, he was no billed. He was found not to be in any way guilty of breaking the law. Now, did he do the right thing? I don't think so. Today, if you ask Joe Horn, did he do the right thing or would he do the same thing again? I don't think he would. I don't think Trevon, given that same set of I don't think George Zimmerman, given that same set of circumstances now, would get out of his car.
Now, Bob, I understand that, and I know the Horn case perfectly, so I was just as upset with that case. And to tell you the truth, that case was likely worse than the Trayvon Martin case, because this guy got out of the house after a neighbor's house was burglarized and shot two of the guys, one of them in the back. I remember that very well. And it turned out, again, what did those guys look like again, Mr. Price? Like me. They were Latino. Were they like me, they were Latinos like me, because they were black Colombians. So, I mean, it was quite interesting that. And our thing is that.
Let me tell you something on that. When I first heard that 911 tape and heard what happened, I thought, Horn's toast. He's going to jail. You know, that's it. But I started looking into it. I started reading the law. I talked to the police who were investigating the case. I got into the specifics of it and what the law says. Now, you can debate whether the law is right or wrong or anything else, but what the law says is that once he was out there, once he was in his yard, and he told them to stop and not come towards him, and they did, one of them did, that he was legally justified in using deadly force in self-defense.
Now, Bob,
doesn't mean he was right. Doesn't mean he was right, but he was legally justified.
But here, and that's the thing where a lot of folks talk about. We think, well, let me not say we. Egberto thinks the following. Egberto thinks, as a black man, if I'm in somebody's yard or did that, and somebody has a gun, the mere fact that my hue is of what it is, they are more likely to shoot than if it were somebody of your hue doing exactly the same thing. They may have legal grounds that will justify their shooting, but I think if it's you in the yard, Bob, and me in the yard, I think I get shot. I think the person listened to the dispatcher for you. And that's what we're saying, that when laws are written in a fashion that, because of societal conditioning, they are interpreted differently based on race, based on hue, then the law is unconstitutional. So I think
think the law is unconstitutional?
The law is unconstitutional because which Bill of Rights give us the I forgot. I have to go back to my Constitution. It's one of the Bill of Rights. But anyway,
you're talking about the Fifth Amendment, where it says you can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property
exactly.
Without due process.
Oh, thank
but
you.
People have
Go
to
ahead,
remember
Jason.
When they talk about constitutional rights, which is one of the things that I try to point out all the time, is that though we have to treat each other the proper way, the constitutional rights deal with how the government and we are protected from the government.
Exactly.
But you know what? You're correct. But these are laws written by the government, and that's why I said,
right.
Bob, the law would be unconstitutional.
But the act itself. I mean, I don't agree with the law. I don't agree. Well, let me rephrase that. I don't agree that Mr. Horn didn't do something wrong. I mean, he did do something wrong. I agree with Bob in that regard. I also agree that the law is written, like you say, unconditioning. But unconstitutional. I don't necessarily know if that's the case. I think it's too broad, which could possibly make it unconstitutional because you wouldn't be able to defend it. But normally, when you're dealing with that, it's the defendant that is the one that would argue that the law is unconstitutional, not necessarily society. So that's why I don't think it actually is in that purview.
Okay, well, look, guys, we are now at 10 minutes still. This is where I start. We have about five people I asked to go ahead and give a closing a point of view. First of all, I want to thank everybody. I think this was a very good discussion. I don't think it changed minds immediately, but I think when you have this discussion, everybody gets a chance after the show, after they've listened to other people's point of view, to massage it internally and a lot of times change opinions. I know my opinion's been changed before that way. So let's go to closing. Greg, give me a closing statement.
Hey, this was an absolutely terrific discussion, and I think that's the key word here. I don't see everything the same way that Bob described it, but I got to applaud Bob and congratulate you for being calm and rational. And in fact, for, you know, seeing some of the points of view that I've had in this whole situation, and knowing that there are conservatives out there like you, like a couple other folks in a coffee party like Michael Charney, gives me hope. It gives me hope.
Thank you very much, Greg. And that is, those kudos are real heartfelt, Bob. Jason?
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say that for the people out there, just, again, like I've already been reiterating, just don't believe the stereotypes. You know, I looked on TV and I saw protests where it was mostly white people protesting against Zimmerman. So just whether you're white or black, just don't make assumptions about anyone. Just try to band together and really against stupidity and against racism and things like that.
Thank you very much, Jason. Peggy.
Yes, my point about the protests, my quick point about the protests coming up is that we want to emphasize, to model this empathy energy instead of just coming from a defensive posturing where we're making our argument legal or otherwise. I think if we can get this empathy out and model it, then that will come a long way towards bringing down the walls between people.
That is a very well said statement, Peggy. I appreciate that. John.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say I disagreed a little bit with what the, I guess it was Roberto. I'm not really sure who it was, but he was talking about Al Sharpton, and I'm not saying I agree with everything that Mr. Sharpton does, but I think he's done a great deal to help the African American community, and I consider him a great American. And I hope that these protests, which are happening in 100 cities around the country, are very successful, and I hope Stand Your Ground is repealed. I mean, I know it's a long shot, but I mean, the public seemed like they are waking up, and there is going to be a Senate panel that's going to be reviewing Stand Your Ground laws, and I hope that people will really wake up about how ridiculous these laws are and how this violent society that we live in, and we need to look at the history of racism in our country. I agree that you know, racism is prevalent still to this day, but I think that we can't just say, you know, I'm an American. I mean, and say, you know, that's fine. You know, everybody, race doesn't matter. Race does matter. Race is extremely important. We need to look to our history, understand why people, you know, the African Americans, the Latinos, have been repressed for you know, centuries. And you know, as a white man, you know, I've experienced white privilege, and it's a totally different world. And I used to live in New York City, and you know, to see the way people are treated up there with the Stand Your Ground laws, and to see the oppression that goes on to this day, it's very sad. And I want the country to wake up, because it's not just about race. It's about, you know, you have to remember that, you know, a year ago when they charged George Zimmerman, Alec was right in the center of it. Alec was the one who helped write all of these laws, and all the people responded, you know, greatly. They actually took all these people, like Coca-Cola, all these corporations, and they got out of Alec. You know, they were. You know, a lot of corporations that supported Alec, and all of a sudden the protests were so strong that they got out of Alec. And so Alec is a major problem in America, and I hope that we can bring it to people's attention.
Thank you very much, John. Very well said. Roberto Rodrigo.
I would ask everybody to please not let anyone form your discussion based upon whether or not they are credible or a good American or whatever, that you go and look to the facts as always. The media, the individuals that I mentioned earlier, are trying to form an argument that's not credible. I offer a couple of facts. In a 10-year period, 90% of the murders of black men, black people, were committed by black people. 83% of the murders that were committed against white people were committed by white people. It is a statistical anomaly that there's race murders going on in this country. So while this incident is horrid, and while I disagree that Zimmerman was charged correctly, and I think he should have been convicted of some kind of duplicity in the event, I do believe that there is a polarization going on in this country to divide us. When I say that we should be American, I didn't mean that our ethnic history doesn't matter. What I meant is I want to remove the ethnic divide. We're the only country that does this. We're the only country that does it. People are not African British or Italian French people. We are the only one that does it. The only other divisions there are in this country, in the world, are usually based upon religious orientation. And finally, I'll say the most important thing about everything that we're talking about is that a 17-year-old boy who was not committing a crime before the altercation started is now dead. So we really need to look beyond the divide of the conservatives have one view, the liberals have another. We need to fix this, people. Our youth are being killed.
Thank you very much, Robert. Bob, my guest.
Hey, Bertho, I want to thank you for the invitation to come on, and I really value the input that each of the people listening today offered to the conversation. I think it was a very insightful and thoughtful presentation. On the issue of Al Sharpton, I think he makes a tremendous living off of the divide of the racial issues, and I wish that there was some way that he could be a little more standing up on both sides of the issues. You know, where are, as Roberto asked a minute ago, where are people protesting when the black-on-black crime happens? And these issues need to be talked about further. I hope we can have another opportunity to talk about them on the radio. But, you know, the facts of the case are really kind of irrelevant at this point. The jury's made its decision. But as a society, we have an obligation now to look at that and learn some lessons from it and try to make things better for all of us. And I don't think the Stand Your Ground law has much impact in this issue. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying that a person who feels that their life is in danger may defend their life without responsibility to retreat. I don't think you should have to cower back into the back corner of your bedroom in your house if it's being burglarized before you can defend yourself. So we'll have those discussions and those issues will move forward. I want to say again that I hope everyone on both sides will respect each other's positions this weekend and have peaceful protest and meaningful dialogue. Not much meaningful dialogue happens on the street, unfortunately, so we'll keep doing it here on Egberto's radio show.
Well, look, Bob, I really appreciate you coming on, and I'd love to have you again however many times you want to come, because, again, we want to have a real discussion, and we put people together because that is how you find resolution. We're not asking anybody to adopt any other person's ideology, but we have to remember that here we are in America, we are all one country, we all live together, and just like I like arroz con pollo, you may like chicken and dumplings. And you know what? We still enjoy living in the same country just fine. That's what it's all about. Now, all the guests, Robert, John, Peggy, Jason, Greg, and those that have hung up, and those listening on the Internet and otherwise, thank you for being on the show. I would hope that you would send me some more tweets, send me some more emails so that we can continue this type of discussion. I think it is fruitful. I think it gives us something to think about. When we're not raising our voices and throwing things out, it gives us a chance to give the respectability each one of us deserves. I was very happy to hear Jason come on the show as a black person other than myself on the phone to be able to articulate something that I think having more than one do was more effective. Thank you very much for coming on. Now I have to announce some of our shows. Please remember, on Mondays at 10 p.m., we have Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson. On Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, we have The Middle Ground with Michael Cherny and Eric Beiler. On Thursdays, we have Lunch with Loudon at 3 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, at 1 p.m. Eastern, 12 Central, here you have Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. I'm your host. Thank you for spending some time this Saturday with me. I am going to try to get off to one of the Trayvon Martin's rallies if I can get there. And with that, thank you very much. I'm out. Oh, I forgot. Please go to www.coffeepartyusa.com. Become a member. Join us. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.